Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Thanks to all of you for coming out this evening. Thanks especially to Sam and the TI chapter here for the invitation, and to the TI more generally, which is doing such an extraordinary work for the church and for our intellectual life here and abroad. My title is The Catholic Imagination. I saw some posters earlier that said The Christian Imagination. If you prefer, you can replace the word Catholic with the word Christian in everything I'm about to say, and I think it will still work for you, or at least I mean it to. If you'd like to argue with me about it at the end, I would welcome your questions. Pope Benedict XVI once said, "Art and the saints are the greatest apologetics for our faith." I don't think it's too hard to see why this might be true. Traditionally, the three deepest experiences of human knowing are mystical, moral, and poetic. Mystical knowledge remains in the soul, tending towards silence, as Jacques Maritain, the 20th century Thomist, said once. But moral knowledge expresses itself in a life, and poetic knowledge in a work. Things that others can reach out and touch, and through them find their way back to the mysterious source of that knowledge. And then back out again to the created world and its creator, goodness and beauty, the gifts of artists and saints. They offer us in a special way an invitation from God himself. In 1999, Pope John Paul II wrote a letter to artists. May I ask if any of you read a letter to artists? A couple. Good. The rest of you, shame on you. A beautiful reflection on the nature and purpose of artistic creativity. He says a lot of wonderful things there. Here's just a short paragraph that speaks about literature, which is my particular topic this evening. "The church has need especially of those who can make perceptive and as far as possible attractive the world of the spirit, of the invisible, of God, on the literary and figurative level, using the endless possibilities of images and their symbolic force. Christ himself made extensive use of images in his preaching, fully in keeping with his willingness to become in the incarnation the icon of the unseen God. Literature, therefore, has a special place in the life of Catholicism and Christianity. For it invites us into, as he says, the world of the spirit, of the invisible, and of God himself. The Catholic imagination is my subject this evening. Is a vast country, full of mountains and valleys, forests and deserts, great heights and great depths. Tonight, I'm just going to think with you about the literary corner of that country, and in particular, two important figures, exemplars of some of the central features of the Catholic imagination. And I've chosen them because they're important to me, but also because I hope they're familiar to many of you, and yet also mysterious enough to bear even greater reflection. They are J.R.R. Tolkien and Flannery O'Connor. By the way, the posters that I noticed on campus have a poster of Aslan and Lucy. Now, I'm not going to say much about them this evening, although I just did mention them so that I get some credit. Lewis might be mentioned once or twice. We'll see how it goes. The poster that I saw, which is online, is a poster. It's a frame from Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films, and it's a picture of Bilbo's house, his hobbit hole. And by the way, I had a joke I was going to tell all of you, which I'll still tell, but it's not fun. It's nearly as funny, because in the front of the image of the poster that you all didn't see, there's Bilbo's sign, "No admittance except on party business." And I was hoping to see that outside this room this evening, but no such luck. Let me begin with O'Connor. Born in 1925 in Savannah, Georgia, to Irish Catholic parents from upper-class southern families, Mary Flannery O'Connor was a quiet, intelligent, quick-witted, and rather contrary girl. A writer from a young age, she caused a minor family scandal at the age of 10 by a collection of satiric and uncomfortably close-to-life vignettes titled simply, "My Relatives." "It was in the naturalist vein," she wrote later, "and was not well received." Shortly before her 16th birthday, her father died of lupus, the disease that would one day claim her own life in 1964 at the age of 39. After attending the local women's college, she won a place at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, followed by a stint at Yadu, an artist retreat in upstate New York. After 5 years up north, lupus struck. At the age of 25, she moved back to Milledgeville, Georgia, to live with her mother at Andamusia, the family dairy farm, where she remained for the rest of her life. There, she wrote two novels and a generous handful of short stories infused with her Southern Catholic sensibility. She was then and would remain for the rest of her life a daily communicant whenever possible, and with an eye for hard edge and spiritual truths. Accustomed to reading St. Thomas Aquinas, this is a TI talk, so I was going to mention St. Thomas Aquinas at least once. Accustomed to reading St. Thomas Aquinas each night before going to sleep, she wrote once to a friend that, "If my mother were to come in during this process and say, 'Turn off that light, it's late,' I, with lifted finger and broad beatific expression, would reply, 'On the contrary, I answer that the light, being external and limitless, cannot be turned off. Shut your eyes.'" John Ronald Reuel Tolkien was born in 1892 of English parents in South Africa. At the age of 3, his mother brought him and his brother back to England to visit family, and his father, never in excellent health, died while they were away. His mother supported the two boys on a small income, taught them at home herself, and moved to the bucolic English countryside for the next 4 years. 4 years, wrote Tolkien later. I'm not as good as the English accent, but the longest seeming and most formative parts of my life. They inspired, among other things, the Shire of the Hobbits. At the end of this time, the small family converted to Catholicism, and after the death of his mother when Tolkien was 12, he and his brother were adopted by one of Cardinal Newman's oratorians in Birmingham. A precocious young man who loved languages and myths and legends, Tolkien attended Oxford and studied English. His later essay on the Old English poem Beowulf remains a classic. He married his teenage sweetheart and lived out his life rather quietly as an Oxford professor of English, who intensely loved his Catholic faith, his wife and children, his university work. He managed to spend many hours at night inventing languages, mythical worlds, and discussing them by day with his friends, including, of course, the person I'm not speaking about this evening. C.S. Lewis. By the time of his death in 1973, Tolkien was an international celebrity. Most famous, of course, for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. His books, though deeply Catholic, inspired thousands of 1960s hippies, and it wasn't unusual at the time to find graffiti claiming "Frodo lives," or "Gandalf for president." I feel like that's coming back here, you know. His son Christopher, also an English professor who died just a couple years ago, as some of you might know, dedicated his life to editing and publishing his father's papers. And the Tolkien enthusiast, over the last 15 years, has access to an extraordinarily deep and magical world with its own mythology, heroes, villains, tragedies, and triumphs. Both O'Connor and Tolkien fully express something that I think is the most important feature of the Catholic imagination. When he was writing The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien gave a lecture in 1939 entitled On Fairy Stories. Revised afterwards, finally published in 1947, On Fairy Stories is Tolkien's most important reflection on the nature of his own creative writing and on Catholic fiction more broadly. At the end of the essay, Tolkien comes to the final characteristic of fairy stories, what he calls the consolation of the happy ending. "Tragedy is the true form of drama," it says, "its highest function. But the opposite is true of fairy story. Since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, I will call it eucatastrophe. The eucatastrophic tale is the true form of the fairy tale and its highest function." Tolkien speaking here of fairy stories in particular, but eucatastrophe is of a much wider application than the otherworldly fantasy Tolkien was describing. It's the mark of the Catholic imagination as such. And let me just ask, have any of you seen the film Calvary, which is an Irish movie? Good. Two of you maybe, yeah. Maybe 15 years old or so, 10, 15 years. It appears tragic. There's a main character who's a priest, And there's a brutal murder at the end of the film. But it's not a tragedy. It's just not a tragedy. It's a catastrophic moment, like exactly this sense. So those of you who haven't seen it, put it on your list. The consolation of fairy stories, this is back to Tolkien's own words, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, of the good catastrophe, the sudden joyous turn. It's a sudden and miraculous grace never to be counted on to recur. It does not deny the existence of discatastrophe or sorrow and failure. The possibility of these is necessary to the joy of deliverance. But it denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal final defeat, and insofar is evangelial, good news, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world. Tolkien's reference here to evangelium is not accidental. As he says later, the eucatastrophe we see in a brief vision in a story may be a far-off gleam or echo of evangelium in the real world. Tolkien thought the Gospels were a fairy tale. The joy of eucatastrophe is the precious joy that satisfies hope. And the Catholic imagination is, above all, hopeful. This doesn't mean that a Catholic story has to end happily ever after. As Flannery O'Connor's fiction shows, the Catholic story would be very grim, indeed. But whatever tragic circumstances befall the characters, whatever pain and sorrow they must endure, the conclusion of a Catholic story, if it does not clearly end in joy, at least leaves open the possibility of joy. As Tolkien says, it denies universal final defeat. No suffering can extinguish every opportunity for redemption, not even, most of all, the cruel jaws of death itself. We'd be hard-pressed to find a more pure expression of eucatastrophe than Flannery O'Connor's novels and stories. Dark as they seem, full of murders and sneering children and trickster vagabonds, her fiction is nonetheless profoundly Catholic, most of all because it is so hopeful. Despite the bloodshed, all of them, so I maintain, end with a eucatastrophe, and so all of them have, dare I say, happy endings. Now, how many of you have read at least one O'Connor story? How many of you read more than five? Okay, good. I'm going to retell The River. This is a story published in 1953 when she was 28. It's one of two of her stories that ends with a child's accidental suicide. The plot of The River is straightforward. Harry Ashfield, a boy 4 or 5 years old, was picked up one Sunday morning from his house by Mrs. Conn, his babysitter for the day. She took him to her house, a half-mile walk from the end of the town streetcar line, where her three boys tricked him into letting out a pig, who chased Harry, terrified, back to the house. Later that afternoon, Mrs. Conn took Harry and her children down to the river, where an itinerant preacher was speaking to a small crowd. "Listen to what I got to say, you people," he said. "There ain't but one river, and that's the river of life, made out of Jesus' blood. That's the river you have to lay your pain in the river of faith, in the river of life, in the river of love, in the rich red river of Jesus' blood, you do. It's a river full of pain itself moving toward the kingdom of Christ, to be washed away. Slow, you people, slow as this here old red river water round my feet." Mrs. Conn suddenly brought Harry to the front and presented him for baptism. Harry was thrust under the water and emerged spluttering while the preacher said, "You count now. You didn't even count before." When Mrs. Conn brought Harry home, his parents were in the middle of another evening party. When the preacher asked Harry earlier about his mother's ailment so he could call on Jesus to heal her, Harry innocently replied, "She has a hangover." Harry's mother eventually came in to say goodnight in order to ask what lies he'd been telling today. The next morning, Harry woke up late and wandered around the apartment, eating a couple crackers spread with anchovy paste and drinking some leftover ginger ale. Bored, he calculated that his parents would get up after 1 in the afternoon. Suddenly, he left the house, took the streetcar out of town, and returned to the river, where he waded in, and after a few unsuccessful tries, drowned himself. For an instant, the story says, he was overcome with surprise. Then, since he was moving quickly and knew that he was getting somewhere, all his fury and his fear left him. We could dull the sharp edge of this story by treating it as an allegory. O'Connor's clearly thinking about the way that baptism works, and especially the Catholic doctrine of baptism of desire. The story is full of images of death and the devil. Three times Mrs. Conan is called a skeleton. First a speckled skeleton, then a musical skeleton, and finally a woman who stares with a skeleton's appearance of seeing everything. And when Mrs. Conan, her children, and Harry make their way to the river, they look like the skeleton of an old boat. The preacher has a face all bone and red light reflected from the river. The pig that chases Harry seems merely a malicious trick until we find a few pages later that Mrs. Conan reads to Harry from an old children's book, The Life of Jesus Christ for Readers Under 12. It was full of pictures, O'Connor writes, one of a carpenter driving a crowd of pigs out of the van. They were real pigs, gray and sour looking. Gray and sour, two words that pick up the description of the Conan's all too real pig who nosed its gray and sour and wet face into Harry's. And as Harry is drowning himself, he sees the skeptic from yesterday's crowd, Mr. Paradise, bounding after him like a giant pig and shouting, driving, of course, to save him from the river. The first piece of dialogue we get is the claim that Harry ain't fixed right. His arm is hung up in the sleeve of his coat. Well then, for Christ's sake, fix him, is the father's reply. An oath repeated later when, after Mrs. Conan announces to Harry's mother that the preacher prayed for her to be healed, she replies, healed? Healed of what, for Christ's sake? And his father says farewell that first morning by saying, goodbye, old man. Perhaps a reference to the old man, Adam, of the Apostle Paul, who says in Colossians, do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his practices and have put on the new man, who's being renewed in knowledge after the image of his creator. Harry himself is described as mute and patient, like an old sheep waiting to be let out. And he tricks Mrs. Conan into calling him by a new name, the name with which the preacher baptizes. So we can ease the pain and shock of this story of a neglected little boy who accidentally drowns himself by reading the story as a dramatization in the trappings of the American South, of the mystery of baptism. And the symbolism's no doubt there. But we fail to do O'Connor justice, I think, if we take such an easy way out. If the story's any good, it has to work on the literal level as well as a symbolic one. I find that readers sometimes react to this story on a little literal level with something approaching horror. That is, the story must be a tragedy. And describes some of the many ways we can fail our children. But, and I haven't really conveyed this at all, I'm afraid, the story is without a doubt more comic than tragic. Who can resist the humor of Mrs. Conan's disdain for an abstract painting she sees on the wall of Harry's house? I wouldn't have paid for that, she says, nodding at the painting. I would have drew it myself. Then a few paragraphs later, she gives the watercolor another look and concludes, wouldn't even drew it. This story is a comedy not just in the details, though its details are very funny, but as a whole, for it ends happily, doesn't it? If we take Catholicism seriously, then little Harry makes his way to heaven by the last page. Of course, we can respond that little boy isn't supposed to get to heaven that way. Harry is ignorant, no doubt, and takes what the preacher says at face value and doesn't see that he's drowning himself. So we can't think of him as committing a sin of self-destruction. But wouldn't things have been better had they turned out differently? I suppose that must be true. Had his parents loved him properly, or if he had understood more of the world and how Jesus wants to save us, he wouldn't have thought the way that Jesus was downriver. There are all sorts of ways of imagining a better life and death for Harry. But what about the Harry that we see in this story? this particular little boy, who might at any time be smitten by God's providence, struck by lightning, run over, overcome by any number of things that bring down thousands of people in the world over every day. How exactly is this particular boy's death a tragedy for him? Assuming, of course, that Christianity is true, and that we should not expect Harry to be anywhere else than surely with Jesus that very day in paradise. You catastrophe, indeed. Well, Connor's stories abound with this kind of ending. Hazel Motes, how many of you read Wiseblood? One and two. Her first novel, great novel. Hazel Motes, the protagonist of her first novel, Wiseblood, dies of exposure, followed by a blow to the head, but only at the conclusion of a lengthy spiritual purification. I'm about to ruin a bunch of stories. I apologize for that. Lengthy spiritual purification. Ruby Hill, in A Stroke of Good Fortune, comes to the slow and terrifying realization that she's pregnant, but we clearly are meant to understand it's the best thing that ever happened to her. Three young arsonists set alight Mrs. Cope's woods in the conclusion. Woods afire in the conclusion to A Circle in the Fire, and that seems the only thing that could possibly shake her out of her spiritual complacency. And even though Mrs. May ends Greenleaf, gored to death by a bull, she dies with the look of a person whose sight has been suddenly restored, but who finds the light unbearable. As bent over the bull, she appears to whisper some last discovery into the animal's ear. I think this story, by the way, is a rewriting of Francis Thompson's Hound of Heaven, a very famous poem, Catholic poem of the late 19th century. I've been describing O'Connor's stories as eucatastrophic, hopeful, in the Catholic eschatological sense, each one ended in some fashion by a fierce encounter with God's grace. O'Connor's characters are broken, sinful people, but she loves them nonetheless, and she always offers them the chance of salvation. Here is how she herself explains the hard, unyielding texture of her stories. Everyone needs, of course, to be lifted up. There's something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands the redemptive act, that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. The reader today looks for this motion, and rightly so, but what he has forgotten is the cost of it. His sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether, and so he's forgotten the price of restoration. There are ages when it is possible to woo the reader. There are others when something more drastic. O'Connor wrote as she did, if we take this paragraph seriously, because as a Catholic she needed to write hopeful fiction. Fiction that held out at least the possibility of redemption. But to make such spiritual realities visible in stories that would work for her readers, for us today, she needed the tools of distortion, tools that resulted in fiction that is wild, violent, and tonic. Now, I've been speaking about Flannery O'Connor's stories as compelling, even pure examples of the hopeful, eucatastrophic Catholic imagination. But O'Connor's explanation of the importance of the grotesque and the distorted in her stories, the absence of wooing, and the focus on pain and one's preparation for death, they help me explain two other important characteristics of Catholic literature. Things that are in a certain amount of tension. Tolkien's description of eucatastrophe appears at the end of On Fairy Stories. At the very beginning of that essay, Tolkien remarks that it is man who is, in contrast to fairies, supernatural and often of diminutive stature. Whereas they, fairies, are natural, far more natural than he. Such is their doom. The road to fairyland is not the road to heaven, nor even to hell, I believe, though some have held that it may lead thither indirectly. There's something non-eternal, for good or ill, about fairyland for Tolkien. As if fairyland is about fairyland and not some other thing. O'Connor wants to pull into focus all the supernatural things tied to the everyday world of our senses. Heaven and hell, angels and demons, sin and grace. Fairyland, by contrast, is content just with itself. Tolkien, for example, clearly loved the magical, the enchanted, the fantastic, and the adventurous. If I could risk an extension of his vocabulary, I would say that he loved the pagan. By pagan, I don't really mean ancient polytheistic religion. I mean instead all of creation, insofar as it dwells within itself, rejoicing in its glorious splendor, even though aware of its own mysterious imperfection. For Tolkien, the true Catholic can out-pagan the pagans. How so? By celebrating the exquisitely bittersweet beauty of everything around us in all its transient glory. Catholics, Christians more broadly, have the fullest possible appreciation of the splendor of the natural world because we know that God deigned to join it to himself in the person of his Son. The beauty of the sensuous, its tastes and textures, the songs of birds, the blues of the sky, the moist pungency of freshly turned earth. Even though Catholics celebrate them even more than any pagan could, knowing that they come from God, just because they do come from God, they are worth joyfully celebrating, experiencing in their own right as things in themselves. I think this is the kind of joy Tolkien takes in the natural world, and that he tries to create anew for us in his invented worlds. Tolkien is best known for Hobbits and Rings, but I want to retell you a lesser-known short story of his called Leif by Nicol. How many of you have heard of read Leif by Nicol? Came in right. Good. I know I'm spoiling a bunch of stories. You all should go back and read them anyway. They are much richer than I'm giving you, I'm afraid, and they will repay careful attention. Leif by Nicol, written right around the time of On Fairy Stories in the early 1940s, when Tolkien is writing The Lord of the Rings. The story goes like this. Nicol is a little man who had a long journey to make, but he did not want to go, and he put off his preparations. He was also a painter, though not a very good one. One particular picture eventually captured all his attention. It had begun with a leaf caught in the wind, and it became a tree. Then all around the tree and behind it, through the gaps in the leaves and boughs, a country began to open out, and there were glimpses of a forest marching over the land, and of mountains tipped with snow. Nicol lost interest in his other pictures, and his canvas for this picture grew so that he needed a ladder to reach the top portions. When neighbors called, he was polite, but underneath he was always thinking of his painting. As time went on, his garden became neglected, and Nicol's time became even more precious as his troublesome journey grew closer. One day, his neighbor Parrish knocked and begged Nicol to go to town for the doctor for his sick wife, he himself being unable to go because of his lame leg. Nicol went, cursing under his breath, and fetched the doctor in the middle of a storm. Parrish's wife, of course, turned out not sick at all. Parrish and his wife were accustomed to ask many favors of Nicol for the sake of their own convenience. But Nicol caught a terrible cold and hadn't yet recovered before the driver came to take him on his long-awaited journey. After some years in a hospital, where he was made to do various jobs, and which eventually he did very well, he was sent to a new country. Upon arrival, he fell off his bicycle, for before him stood the tree, his tree, finished. If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind that Nicol had so often felt or guessed and had so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree, and slowly he lifted his arms and opened them wide. "It's a gift," he said. After some time improving the land about the tree, Parrish himself joined him. "Nicol's picture," said Parrish in astonishment. "Did you think of all this, Nicol? I never knew you were so clever. Why didn't you tell me?" Another man said, "He tried to tell you long ago, but you would not look. He'd only got canvas and paint in those days, and you wanted to mend your roof with them. This is what you and your wife used to call Nicol's nonsense, or that daubing." But it did not look like this then, not real, said Parrish. No, it was only a glimpse then, said the man. You might have caught the glimpse, if you'd ever thought it worthwhile to try. And then they both departed, leaving his tree for the mountains. He was going to learn about sheep, the story continues, and the high pasturages, and look at a wider sky, and walk ever further and further towards the mountains, always uphill. Even little Niggle in his old home could glimpse the mountains far away, and they got into the borders of his picture. But what they are really like, and what lies beyond them, only those can say who have climbed them. Sometime later, there's a conversation held about Niggle's country. It's proving very useful indeed as a holiday and a refreshment. It's splendid for convalescence, and not only for that, for many it's the best introduction to the mountains. It works wonders in some cases. I'm sending more and more there. They seldom have to come back. I hope the theme of co-creation with God is clear enough in this story. Niggle's painting is, in a way, Tolkien's own mythological world, of which The Lord of the Rings is only a small part, a little leaf. And by inventing his tree and its country, Niggle continues in his own way the divine creative activity of God himself. What makes this story so thoughtful, though, is the way Niggle's painting is taken up into eternity. Niggle's journey by train after the storm to the hospital is clearly his death. And his long work afterwards at various odd jobs in the hospital, a form of purgatory. His time then in the countryside, in the company of his completed tree after he leaves the hospital, is remarkable. I think it's the beginning of heaven, the foothills, so to speak, before the divinity proper of the mountains. Tolkien suggesting that the artist, the sub-creator, is adding to creation, and as such is contributing to heaven itself. I think we'd be hard-pressed to find a more powerful affirmation of the created world, in this case the created world of the artist, for Niggle's painting is good in itself and worth spending time on, and so good, in fact, that it gets taken up into eternity. If I could hazard a one-word name for the kind of hopeful Catholic writing Tolkien gave us, I'd return to the word pagan, in the sense I tried to explain a few minutes ago. That is, his writing has a special appreciation for the created world, the things that are not God, even if of God. O'Connor's interested in something else. Instead of pagan stories, she always makes us see the inadequacy of the natural world, its impoverishment in contrast with the divine. While we are alive on this earth, we'll suffer, for we are a pilgrim people, and we should not expect real joy before we die and rise again. On the contrary, like the early martyrs, we should not, rather, yearn to die, especially to die for Jesus. It's dangerous to linger over the good things of the earth. It's not our true home. Let's come back to the river for a moment, and the language O'Connor uses to describe her characters. I've already mentioned the gray and sour pigs, the skeletal appearance of Mrs. Conan, the preacher. Here's how she describes the sun. Those of you who know some of O'Connor's stories, the sun is a critical character in every story. First appears the gray morning. Later, the white Sunday sun climbing fast through a scum of gray cloud as if it meant to overtake them. Later, it is rolling away ahead of them. When Harry's at the river, he sees the pieces of the white sun scattered in the river. And later, the air was so quiet he could hear the broken pieces of the sun knocking in the water. The next morning, the sun came in palely, stained gray by the glass. Finally, on his way to the river for the last time, the sun was pale yellow and high and hot. The words lined up alongside sun include pieces, scattered, stained, glass, pale, and so on. Words of omnipresence and penetrating power rather than gentle beauty. The human characters, for their part, are glum and limp, looming, toneless, with collapsed mouths. They glance severely. and so on. The tension O'Connor builds into this story by means of her vocabulary, the power of the son, the weakness of the human characters, is so powerful that the reader, like Harry himself, feels the release of the final paragraph, where the language smooths out. The waiting current caught him like a long, gentle hand and pulled him swiftly forward and down. For an instant he was overcome with surprise, then since he was moving quickly and knew that he was getting somewhere, all his fury and his fear left him. If we're absorbed in this story as fully as its author must have intended, we should feel the same way. We are leaving the world behind. And thank goodness. It is, I think, quite simply impossible to imagine Tolkien's Middle-earth described in this way. O'Connor's stories are powerful, in large part because they force us to confront our eternal destiny and to remember how little everything else matters in comparison. God's grace in her world is just like that long, gentle hand, pulling, always pulling us down and through this world and into the next. Her imaginative writing, rather than taken, might best be called prophetic. It was the word she claimed for herself, for her form of writing. O'Connor's prophetic voice cries out to us from the wilderness, "Make straight the way for the Lord." Her writing demands that we take our life seriously as a journey towards death and judgment. And as the preacher says to Mr. Paradise, glancing towards him with a raised fist, "Believe Jesus or the devil, testify to one or the other." Tolkien, on the other hand, writes to woo us as a lover, offering the beauty and joy of his creations. It's true that these creations reflect supernatural divine realities. They can, too, can be, or surely meant to be, means of ascent to beauty itself, as is Nichols' picture. But they can work in this way only if they themselves really are beautiful, and so really are worth lingering over for their own sakes. They are at least potentially distractions. There's a reason, after all, that Tolkien's fiction made it onto the shelves of the hippies, and O'Connor's didn't. All true Catholic fiction is hopeful, comic, in the older, broader sense. But sometimes we need prophets who will remind us that we are on a pilgrimage. And sometimes we need lovers who will show us a beautiful, sensuous world, redeemed and glorious. All of us at one time or another need both. I don't mean to simplify all this by suggesting that the Catholic imagination of Flannery O'Connor can just be balanced with that of Tolkien, as if we just needed a varied diet. Two helpings of Tolkien, please, with a side of O'Connor. These two different ways of writing, of expressing the mysteries of our Catholic faith, are to a certain extent in real tension with one another. One of those tensions that is at the heart of Catholicism. As Catholics and as Christians, we should long for death, since only then will we be with our Savior. But likewise, we should long for life, since life is a gift from our Creator to be celebrated to the fullest. Such things are unavoidably mysterious, as well as exhilarating, and they remind us of the varied and powerful ways that Catholic writers, as John Paul II said so well, make perceptive, and as far as possible attractive, the world of the spirit, of the invisible, and of God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.